This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
MLK.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of Organicology, the Northwest's largest gathering of the organic food trade. Study the organic industry and shape the future of sustainable eating. February 7th through 9th at the Hilton, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's Organicology, February 7th through 9th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/organic2013.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
On Wednesday, January 16th, KBOO will broadcast The Talk by Michelle Alexander on the new Jim Crow, racism and the criminal justice system, along with a community forum on police and the Portland community. Listen to The Talk live on KBOO Radio from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday on 90.7 FM and also heard on the web at kboo.fm.
And get together, break up this old Jim Crow. Pick it up now.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Mohamed Mahmoud trial continued today in a Portland courthouse.
A Northeast Portland family was evicted from their home this morning. Occupy Portland protesters helped fight the eviction.
And supporters of the Affordable Health Care Act for All, Oregon, plan a rally in front of the state legislature next month.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 16th, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Early this morning, Multnomah County Sheriffs, along with the Portland Police, moved in to evict a family from their home in Northeast Portland. Ron and Debbie Austin and their two kids have been actively fighting their foreclosure eviction with the help of activists from We Are Oregon and Occupy Portland. The Rapid Response Network sent out text messages to supporters who gathered at 5 a.m. this morning at the home. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was at the eviction this morning and brings us this report. This starts with the voice of Debbie Austin as she is being evicted, saying that her country has turned against her.
And my country's turned against me. I know that sounds funny because it's just a house, but it's not. It's the whole thing. It's all of it. They turned against me. My father fought in the Korean War, in the Second World War. My grandfather fought in the World War, First World War. My great-great-grandfather's fought to free the slaves. My stepson is in the army right now going to Afghanistan while his father is being evicted out of his home. That's not right. I made those payments. I made those payments, and the judge is wrong. We get a lawyer. Show me a lawyer that will take a case that he can't win because of the laws.
The Rapid Response Network is standing on the sidewalk in the street corner with the family, thinking through our next steps. But for now, they have been forcefully evicted from their house, and the house is being monitored by private security inside the home 24/7. They are paying people to make sure that the house stays empty. And that is the current situation at the Austin's home.
Was there any resistance when the police showed up?
The family didn't offer any resistance from inside the home besides calling the Rapid Response Network. We know that the police and the sheriff came at about 5 in the morning when there was Debbie and her two children in the home. They were aroused from sleep by the officers banging and, forcing the door. So there was, I think that at 5 in the morning, it was a little, they were doing what they could to get their stuff together and stay out of harm's way.
And this was a combined sheriff and police operation?
That's my understanding at this point, is that it was both the police and the sheriffs working together to evict the family.
Do we know how many officers were on the scene?
I don't know exact numbers, but at least a dozen.
And the Austin family has been in their home expecting a possible eviction for a while. I'm looking up and down the street here, and there are signs in almost every yard that say, we support our neighbors, don't move out. What's that?
The Austins have been talking to their neighbors and canvassing their neighbors for the past, gosh, maybe months now about their situation, and they have a very supportive neighborhood. The neighbors are extremely supportive of this. When the rapid response arrived, the neighbors were already out of their houses asking the Austins what was going on, and the neighbors are where the Austins will be staying during this time of transition. And so the neighbors have put up signs in their front yards to show their support for the family, and are doing material aid to make sure that the family stays safe and healthy during this time.
I'm talking with Angela McGuinney with We Are Oregon, and Angela's been involved with this struggle to help keep Debbie Austin and Ron Austin in their home. There are quite a few people out here to assist in some way the Austins who are facing this police repression. What are the next steps?
So for the moment, the Austins are going to take a minute and regroup. It's really traumatic to get kicked out of your house first thing in the morning by a group of police. But for the community, the next steps are really to gather around the Austins, support them, and in the next 24 hours, we'll have alerts about actions and ways that everybody can stand with the Austins and say we won't accept this in our neighborhoods.
And how can our listeners be of assistance?
Well, if you have not joined the Rapid Response Network, that is one of the best ways to stay up on all the different ways that you can support families like the Austins. And you can sign up for that by going to We Are Oregon's website, www.weareoregon.org. And coming up very soon, we'll have a whole range of ways that folks can assist, from coming to actions to actually doing some national letter writing and support towards Fannie Mae, who is actually the group evicting the Austin family.
All right. Thank you very much, Angela McGuinney. We Are Oregon.
The group We Are Oregon has called for supporters of the Austin family to gather at 4 p.m. tomorrow, January 17th, at the Austin home at 4207 Northeast 77th Avenue to call on the Multnomah County Sheriff to place a moratorium on foreclosure evictions in Portland.
Young Oregonians eligible for the Deferred Deportation Program will now be allowed to get driver's licenses. The Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles announced the decision today, which will impact over 16,000 young people who grew up in Oregon but have no path to legal citizenship. Last month, the department announced that it would refuse driver's license to these young people, then retracted its decision and continued discussion with the Oregon Department of Justice. Today's announcement will allow anyone with a deferred deportation work permit to apply for a license to drive in Oregon. The deferred deportation program created by President Obama last year allows these young people who were brought to the U.S. as children to remain in the country and attend college, but still provides no path to citizenship. To be eligible for the program, a person must have been brought to the U.S. before age 16, be under 30, and have graduated from high school or served in the military.
Crook County Sheriff Jim Hensley sent a letter to Joe Biden today claiming that he will not enforce any federal gun law that he believes to be unconstitutional. Hensley's letter was a copy of the one sent by Linn County Sheriff Tim Mueller to Vice President Biden on Monday. The letter accuses politicians of attempting to exploit the deaths of innocent victims. This letter also complains that new gun laws will infringe upon the civil liberties of law-abiding citizens. Mueller's original letter was posted on Facebook, where it received more than 16,000 shares and 13,000 likes. Douglas County Sheriff John Hanlon sent a separate letter, which he claimed would not engage in or tolerate any enforcement action deemed to be unconstitutional. County sheriffs in Oregon are generally responsible for enforcing state and local laws, and generally the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or ATF, is tasked with enforcing federal gun laws. Presumably, this would be the case under any new laws as well, although sheriffs might be asked to cooperate in ATF investigations.
Former Portland Mayor Sam Adams was named this morning as Executive Director of the City Club of Portland. Sam Adams' four-year term as mayor ended December 31st when he was replaced by Mayor Charlie Hales. The City Club of Portland is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group dedicated to policy analysis and research. As executive director, Adams will focus on fundraising and membership development. His salary will be around $80,000, and he will oversee a staff of three employees. According to Adams, he was one of 80 other applicants.
When the new legislative session begins in Salem on Monday, February 4th, about 1,000 protesters will march to the Capitol steps in support of Representative Michael Dembrow's Affordable Health Care for All Oregon Act. The protest is called the Rally for Health Care is a Human Right. KBOO's Ben Renner spoke with Peter Shapiro, the chairman of the Health Care Committee with Portland Jobs with Justice.
Why support the Health Care Act?
Well, clearly we need it. The Affordable Care Act, although it has brought certain patient protections that didn't exist before that are valuable to people, it clearly is not solving the health care crisis. It hasn't stopped the runaway cost of health insurance. You know, health doctors' bills continue to be the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country, and Congress really did not deal with it. They cobbled together a compromise law which basically amounted to a huge handout to the insurance industry, in return for which we got some needed protections, but nothing that will make our system function any more rationally. So we in Oregon and in a bunch of other states, too, we're basically trying to get some state legislation through because we feel if Congress won't do the job, we need to start in our own backyard. And hopefully if enough states pass laws like this, it'll put pressure on Congress to get its act together. Vermont, I think, as many people know, has already passed a law, and they're moving in that direction, and we take a lot of inspiration from them.
Is there anything in the bill maybe that you would have issue with?
The big problem with any kind of state legislation, I think, is that it operates in a legal environment where you have to deal with the feds. There is a whole host of federal regulations and laws that get in the way of a state implementing a true single-payer system where basically everybody is in the same risk pool, everybody has the same benefits and the same kind of coverage, and everybody gets equal treatment and adequate treatment. Until we deal with the problem of federal legislation, we're only going to be able to come up with a kind of an approximation of a fair system at the state level. And I think this is something that we in Jobless Justice are very much aware of. We see state legislation as a stepping stone, a way to organize a mass movement here in Oregon that will eventually result in federal legislation. That's our goal.
How many people do you think are going to show up for this?
Well, we're shooting for 1,000, and I think we have a fighting chance of getting it. We have, here on the Jobs of Justice website in Portland, people can go to it, jwjpdx.org, and sign up for the buses we're sending down. We're also organizing carpools at the same website. We had 200 demonstrate on the Capitol steps when the bill was introduced 2 years ago. So that's an indication of how much this movement is taking off.
Will you have any speakers at the rally at all? Anybody giving talks?
Well, what we're trying to do is have people who have had bad experience in the healthcare system get up and talk about their experiences briefly and use the rally to demonstrate, just ordinary people, not celebrities or, you know, big spokespeople, but ordinary people who've been burned by the system and who can demonstrate by their own experience the need for, you know, radical change in the way we deliver healthcare in this country. That's the thrust of it. The one person I know who is confirmed for the rally and will be providing music is Norman Sylvester, the Portland blues man who's going to be performing the healthcare blues. That alone ought to make it worth the price of the ticket.
Yeah, no kidding.
That was KBOO's Ben Renner speaking with Peter Shapiro with Portland's Jobs with Justice. Supporters of the Affordable Health Care Act for All Oregon can go to Jobs with Justice's website, www.jwjpdx.org, for more information about the rally.
Today marked the fourth full day in the trial of Mohammed Mahmoud, a local resident who allegedly tried to set off a bomb during the Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland 2 years ago. Undercover FBI agents spent over a year meeting with Mohammed and are accused of urging him to engage in violence. KBOO's Joe Meyer was there and joins us for this live report.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, Joe. Could you give us an update on what has happened in the trial so far?
Well, yesterday the government called undercover agent Yusuf to the stand. Yusuf was the defendant's main handler and was posing as an Al-Qaeda recruiter. Since the facts of the case are basically not disputed, the evidence and testimony really centered around the defendant's state of mind. The prosecution presented audio and video clips and emails arguing that the defendant was in imminent danger before the FBI contact, showed his resolve by completing several tasks, like buying toggle switch and other kind of fake bomb parts. He was given several chances to get out, and yet he was determined to continue, and that he took his own initiative several times. So obviously they're anticipating the entrapment defense and saying he's taking his own initiative. In the videos, he appeared to be under the influence of marijuana. And in fact, in the September 7th video from the Marriott Hotel, the defendant asked the agent, "You got something to burn?" And the FBI replied, "By all means, please do." So I take that to mean not only was he using marijuana, the FBI at least knew that if they weren't supplying it to him. That brings us to this morning. Public Defender Hayes cross-examined Youssef, arguing that the defendant was manipulated and controlled. He was a naive and hapless youth, and the FBI were the experienced older men that Youssef looked up to. You know, typical exchange consisted of the defense asking a series of questions, typically with a one-word answer yes, or disputation, in which case the defense would provide evidence to remind the FBI agent. A typical example might be you knew that he was had strayed from his religious beliefs. You knew he read extremist websites. Yes, yes. You knew he was familiar with jihad language and used it with his friends. Yes. You knew he was conflicted and provided guidance. And then the FBI agent said, "Oh, no, not religious guidance." And then the defense played a tape of the FBI agent saying, "Allah has a good reason for you to do this." And then the FBI would admit, "Yes, this is true." She provided examples that he was not really that competent. He did finish some tasks. He was able to buy a toggle switch, but he could never figure out what the timer was and never got that. It took over a month for him to get the storage unit. He basically needed constant prompting and two visits by two FBI agents. At the end, they just said, "Hey, why don't you go over there and get that one?" and basically pointed to a place because he couldn't figure out how to use a phone book or he didn't even know what a storage unit was. The defense also points out that that an FBI agent named Bill Smith had contact with Muhammad well before Youssef, and so this is really coloring it. Youssef is saying, "Oh, he was already radicalized." Not a defense of saying, "Well, the FBI had contact with him before that." Interestingly, that evidence is somehow not to be admitted. I'm not sure why. There's a little bit of back and forth every day about what evidence is to be shown. My understanding is nothing about prior contact is to be shown, and none of the debriefings is to be shown, which I don't understand, and it seems like there's important stuff in there, but I think that's just the way it is now.
Interesting. Was there any indication of what might happen in the trial tomorrow?
Well, the second undercover agent, Hussein, took the stand a little bit this afternoon. They didn't get in too deep. He will continue tomorrow. So he was the undercover operative posing as an Al-Qaeda bomb expert. And he had also a lot of interactions with the defendant. The defense also brought up the missing tape, and she basically said, "We're just going to have to figure out that at some point, because that's too important." She brought up other missing evidence. I would say, you know, basically the case is it's all about entrapment. It's all about the entrapment line. Did the government go too far? The defense argues that the FBI used basically social science techniques and religious pressure to manipulate him. And the FBI is saying, "Well, you know, what do you want us to do? We're just speaking his language. We can't just say we're from the FBI. We have to really play the role." So that's how it's unwinding so far.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, thank you.
Again, we've been speaking with KBOO's Joe Meyer, reporting live on the trial of Mohammed Mahmoud, accused of the attempted bombing of the Portland Christmas tree lighting 2 years ago.
Areas of southern and central Oregon are experiencing stagnant air pollution, which is unhealthy for children and the elderly. An air stagnation advisory was issued because of temperature inversions and pollution spikes. These areas include parts of Klamath and Lake counties, along with parts of Jackson, Josephine, Curry, and Douglas counties. People with lung and heart conditions, children, older adults, and pregnant women should limit outdoor activity, especially in the morning and evening when pollution is highest. Residents in these areas are also asked to stop any open burning and unnecessary heating with wood.
Starting this Thursday, the Selwood Bridge will be closed for a week. Over the course of the week, the bridge will be shifted slightly to the north. The bridge will be moved in one piece using hydraulic jacks rather than being dismantled and replaced by a temporary bridge. This technique, which is called the shoofly process, will shave $10 million off the cost of the project. After the move is finished, the Selwood Bridge will be used as a temporary bridge while a new bridge is constructed. The new bridge will cost over $300 million and will be completed in 2016. The Selwood Bridge is currently the busiest two-lane bridge in Oregon. The Selwood Bridge was given a federal sufficiency rating of 2 out of 100. Bridges with a score of over 50 are considered safe and adequate.
A new bill proposed in the Oregon House would give TriMet operators and mechanics the right to strike. Contrary to what one would expect, this bill is favored by TriMet management and goes against a pact action of the Automated Transit Union, or ATU. The ATU was instrumental in getting TriMet named a no-strike agency in 2007. The passage of this bill would strip TriMet unions of their current right to collective arbitration. Under collective arbitration, the ATU and TriMet management each file their own proposals, which are reviewed by a third-party arbitrator. The ATU has continued to dispute a decision made last summer by arbitrator David Gaba. Gaba sided with the TriMet management because of high health care costs, despite his expressed misgivings about certain parts of their plan. His decision would have allowed TriMet to recoup almost $10 million in health care costs and made employees responsible for 10% of their health care fees. The ATU appealed GABA's decision, which led to a judge requiring TriMet to refund its employees $3 million. The prolonged dispute over the arbitrator's decision has led TriMet management to openly advocate for an end to arbitration and an end to the no-strike status of TriMet's employees. The ATU could not be reached for comment before airtime.
This morning, Jay Inslee was sworn in as the 23rd governor of Washington and gave his inaugural address. Inslee narrowly won election over his Republican opponent, Rob McKenna, with 51% of the vote. He faces a nearly $1 billion deficit, which he promises to solve without raising taxes. Inslee lost a previous bid for governor of Washington in 1996 to Gary Locke between serving two terms in the House of Representatives. His predecessor, Governor Chris Gregoire, gave her final State of the Address speech yesterday. State of the State speech.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned immediately after our broadcast for a live broadcast of Michelle Alexander's lecture on the new Jim Crow, racism and the criminal justice system, and a live community forum on police and the Portland community. At 8 o'clock, it's Drinking from Puddles. Tomorrow's weather should be patchy freezing fog burning off by late morning with high temperatures near 40 degrees.
It's 5:24 in the Post Meridian. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Look out! The fixers are coming. Top corporate chieftains and Wall Street gamblers want to tell Washington how to fix our national debt. So they've created a front group called Fix the Debt to push their agenda. Unfortunately, they're using fix in the same way your veterinarian uses it. Their core demand is for Washington to spay Social Security, castrate Medicare, and geld Medicaid. Of course, a group of pampered, narcissistic billionaires would not make a credible sales team for this dirty work. So Fix the Debt has recruited a bipartisan gaggle of former Congress critters to give their self-serving political gambit a softer public image, a sheen of high public purpose. With a budget of some $40 million, these elder statesmen are doing TV interviews, hosting breakfast sessions with members of Congress, making speeches about mutual sacrifice, and generally going all out to sell the financial elites snake oil. But wait, being an elder does not automatically mean you're a statesman. Let's peek at the resumes of these so-called public-spirited fixers of the debt. Start with Jim McCreary, a former GOP lawmaker. While urging Congress to cut people's programs, he's also a top-paid lobbyist pushing Congress to give more tax subsidies to America's richest people and biggest multinational corporations. Former Democratic Senator Sam Nunn is a fixer, too, but he's also paid $300,000 a year to be a board director for General Electric. Likewise, Democrat Erskine Bowles, a co-founder of the Fixers Front Group, is on the board of Morgan Stanley, drawing $345,000 a year. And former GOP Senator Judd Gregg takes about $1 million a year as advisor to and board member of such giants as Goldman Sachs and Honeywell. This is Jim Hightower saying, I wouldn't want this gang of fixers to pet my dog, much less touch my Social Security. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the New York SAFE Act on Tuesday evening. This is the first gun-related law to be passed in the United States since the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School last December. Governor Cuomo says the 13 new provisions for stricter gun control are just common sense.
7 bullets in a gun. Why? Because the high-capacity magazines that give you the capacity to kill a large number of human beings in a very short period of time is nonsensical to a civil society.
In addition to limiting bullet capacity, the bill calls for a state registry of private gun sales and universal background checks on all prospective gun owners, making it illegal to sell to anyone with a history of mental illness. Some mental health professionals have objected to the law because of a new reporting requirement that they say forces them to break doctor-patient confidentiality.
President Barack Obama unveiled a set of gun regulation proposals today. They include an assault weapons ban, limits on high-capacity magazines, strengthening mental health services, and funding federal research on the causes of gun violence. The measures, developed by a federal task force, come in the wake of 2 more school shootings this week at Hazard Community and Technical College in Eastern Kentucky and the Stevens Institute of Business and Arts in St. Louis, Missouri. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
President Obama signed 23 executive actions on Wednesday aimed at combating gun violence, and the measures can go into effect without approval from Congress.
We will make it easier to keep guns out of the hands of criminals by strengthening the background check system. We will help schools hire more resource officers if they want them, and develop emergency preparedness plans. We will make sure mental health professionals know their options for reporting threats of violence, even as we acknowledge that someone with a mental illness is far more likely to be a victim of violent crime than the perpetrator. And while year after year, those who oppose even modest gun safety measures have threatened to defund scientific or medical research into the causes of gun violence, I will direct the Centers for Disease Control to go ahead and study the best ways to reduce it.
The president called on Congress to fund this research, saying, "We don't benefit from ignorance." He also said lawmakers should quickly approve universal background checks for gun buyers, renew the ban on military-style assault weapons and magazines with more than 10 rounds of bullets, and confirm a director for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The president said he'll soon nominate acting director Ted Jones to lead the agency, which has been leaderless since 2006.
This will be difficult. There will be pundits and politicians and special interest lobbyists publicly warning of a tyrannical, all-out assault on liberty. Not because that's true, but because they want to gin up fear or higher ratings or revenue for themselves.
President Obama and the National Rifle Association have been trading criticisms over the past few weeks. The lobby group is backing the same proposal they announced in the wake of the Newtown shooting, armed guards at every school. They released an online ad this week criticizing the president for not supporting the idea.
Are the president's kids more important than yours? Then why is he skeptical about putting armed security in our schools when his kids are protected by armed guards at their school?
Yet the president's new set of executive orders include incentives for hiring more police for schools, in addition to more counselors, social workers, and school psychologists. The American Civil Liberties Union is one of several groups critical of the idea. In a letter to the president this week, they said the results of over-policing schools can be devastating, particularly for students of color and those with disabilities, and that stepping up the police presence would contribute to the school-to-prison pipeline. But many other organizations, including Mayors Against Illegal Guns, Sandy Hook Promise, and MoveOn.org, are praising the president's actions.
It was absolutely a thrill. I had tears in my eyes listening to his speech. It's all the things that we have been asking for.
That's Pam Simon, who was shot in the chest and arm in the attack in Tucson last January while working as a staffer for Congressmember Gabby Giffords. Now a volunteer with Mayors Against Illegal Guns, she said she especially supports banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, both of which were used in the shooting she survived.
The shooter in the situation with January 8th, he had two 30-round magazines. He discharged 30 bullets in less than 30 seconds, killing 6 people, wounding 13. Some of them will be disabled for the rest of their life because of those wounds. Had he been able to reload, he could have easily killed another 30 people. And it's always been very concerning to me that we have so many firearms, many of which really are only designed for one purpose, and that's killing people rapidly.
Simon will join survivors of other mass shootings in D.C. later this month to pressure members of Congress to vote yes on the president's gun control proposals. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Walmart CEO Bill Simon got a surprise just after speaking at the National Retail Federation Conference Tuesday with a banner drop and a mic check from advocacy groups Our Walmart and the Retail Action Project protesting the company's labor practices. Former employee Walter Arevalo said he was unfairly disciplined for not showing up for his shifts when it was the employer who had made changes to his schedule without notice on several occasions. Arevalo said given the amount of profits Walmart sees, they can well afford to give its workers full-time hours, livable wages, and benefits. As security staff for the convention confronted one speaker, another would take over until the group left when staffers threatened to call police.
Today, the United States military dedicated a 42-acre solar energy array in New Mexico, its largest ever. The array will gather energy